So it's my honour to introduce to you tonight's speaker, Professor Gregory Schaefer, who is Chancellor's Professor of Law at the University of California, Irvine, where he directs the Centre on Globalisation, Law and Society. Prior to joining the University of California, Professor Schaefer was Melvin C. Steen Professor of Law at the University of Minnesota Law School, Wing Tat Lee Chair at Loyola University Chicago School of Law, and Professor at the University of Wisconsin Law School, where he also directed two university research centres on world affairs and the global economy. Those of you who know Greg's work will know him to be amongst the most well-regarded scholars in the fields of international economic law and transnational law more generally. He is famously prolific in his writing and research, having published over 6 books and over 80 articles demonstrating deep knowledge in areas as diverse as biotechnology regulation, developing countries in WTO dispute settlement, transatlantic regulatory cooperation, trade and environment, and most recently an ambitious project with Terry Halliday theorising transnational law and governance at a general level. In each of these areas, he has made major contributions of different types, sometimes by changing the terms of the debate, sometimes by offering new empirical findings, sometimes by synthesising existing theoretical frames and addressing their key inadequacies. His versatility is quite something. He is a leader in the application of socio-legal empirical research methods to international and transnational law, and in that respect has been an inspiration to a whole new generation of scholars of transnational law. He is well known and admired for his generosity in his interactions with colleagues and with younger colleagues in particular, with whom he is always delighted to exchange ideas and offer advice. In tonight's address, Greg will speak to us from his latest body of work with Terry Halliday, which addresses the creation, operation, change and decline of transnational legal orders across areas of social life that transcend the nation state. And as I think is well recognised, the proliferation of new legal forms in the transnational space is in urgent need of adequate re-theorisation. And Greg's new framework is amongst the most promising of only a small handful of alternatives which have so far been offered. So we look forward very much to hearing your thoughts, Greg, and thank you for taking the time to present them to us.
Thank you, Andrew, for that. And it's such a pleasure to be here. I can't imagine being in a more transnational place than London and the LSE in London. So it's really a great honor. I first actually met Andrew years ago, but and of all places, the hotel where the Bretton Woods agreements were signed at a small conference. And I immediately, you know, recognized, because someone who had this incredible sort of modest, unassuming approach. But this is a talk which was absolutely brilliant, which I still remember, and it stuck out from all the other young scholars at that conference. And now it's great to see Andrew in the position that he's in here. So what I was going to do today, I've written a couple books on transnational legal ordering and transnational legal orders, but I thought I would, I was commissioned to write for the Annual Review of Law and Social Science a piece on theorizing transnational legal ordering. And to do so, of course, one should just write about one's own approach, which you should read about everybody who's theorizing transnational legal ordering, and then try to categorize, evaluate, look at the pros and cons. And so I'm using this platform as a way to think through that particular project, which I started to write while I've been here. And so that's what I'll do. And you'll see the categories, of course, overlap, but they also differ and their emphases and what they focus on. And so broadly, just to introduce the categories, there's many theorists, I'd say maybe even most theorists, theorize transnational legal ordering is in terms of private legal ordering. The transnational is the private, right? Lex mercatoria, private regulation by private standard setters and so forth. So that's one primary orientation, which looks at the nature of the actors and looks at the nature of the legal forms, private actors, contract, standard setting, and so forth. It's certainly the rise of private actors in governance. This is central, and we'll look at that. A second major category of theorizing really looks at transnational law purely as a construct. It's a methodological construct. It's not a thing. It's not trying to get at sort of functional equivalence to state-based lawmaking. Rather, it's trying to reconceptualize how we think about law in a complex, functionally differentiated world today to grapple with the crises and problems that beset us. And the third form, of which I am part of, looks at transnational legal ordering in terms of the transnational construction and flow of legal norms that imbricate nation-state and national law. So it involves both public and private international law, public and private law, private lawmaking, and public lawmaking. And it then breaks down, it looks at then the transformation of the state and changes in state institutions, norms, professions, and so forth. So then in thinking about this, I thought it might be good to start just in terms of reflexivity, and that is reflexive of what are the starting points? What's my starting point? What's the starting point of other theorists? And I think it tells a lot about where they go. They're dealing with similar phenomena in terms of the complexity of legal ordering today, the extent of global and transnational interaction of communication networks, technology, capital flows, and so forth, and the normative concerns of the crises that beset us, climate change, financial crises, and others. But at the same time, they come from particular starting points. And so the way I theorize is not as someone who was trained in philosophy or trained in conceptual thinking, but rather someone who started doing empirical work and, in Hannah Arendt's terms, is trying to think of what I do, right? Thinking of what we do. So that's my theorizing is empirically grounded and it's bottom up in that way. It has a Deweyan pragmatist starting point, which is that theory should be grounded in practice, should be grounded in problems, practical problem solving. And when I think about how I got here, it came clearly as part of my training. I started at University of Wisconsin, which was a hotbed of socio-legal study, of empirical study of law, Stuart McCauley, Mark Galanter, David Trubeck, and others. All their starting point was engaged in empirical projects and building theory from what they were, those empirical projects. I also, my starting point, which is different than we'll see many transnational theorists who start from private contract law, is one of my specialties is public international economic law, so studying the global economy. And in studying that, of course, it involves, it interacts with everything. It interacts with human rights, it interacts with environmental law, it interacts with monetary law, it involves law and development, involves a policy space for development and experimentation for development. It raises issues in economics, political science, sociology. It raises concerns in terms of who shapes these norms, who participates in these processes. Not only, first of us to start, what's the role of developing country actors in setting these global norms when they don't even have offices in Geneva? What's the role of different stakeholders in setting these norms? What's the role of private actors who enroll states to act on their behalf? If you look at the very famous or infamous challenge now to Australia's tobacco control regulation for plain packaging, these are Jones Day lawyers and other law firms who are litigating in multiple spaces simultaneously in the United States and for European courts and also globally. And they couldn't get the United States to bring the case, and so they looked for other countries to bring the case. And one of those countries happened to be the Ukraine, which doesn't even export tobacco. Right? But they brought the case before the public international law forum called the World Trade Organization, right? And same with Central American countries and so forth. So once we sort of break down, look empirically into these processes, it raises questions. How do we think then about legal ordering, the shaping, the framing of legal norms? And I'm also interested in the WTO because the WTO implicates national, more than just national law. It deeply concerns what I would call the border between the market and the state, what the state does. It implicates institutional governance within the state. What's the role of courts? What's the role of the executive? What's the role of the central government versus state-level governments and local governments? Right? So it has. So those are just two elements. It also has implications for professions, right? Professionals who suddenly have stakes in law. So think of the importance of the TRIPS Agreement on intellectual property. Now, of globalizing intellectual property law, but the real power of it is that suddenly you have new training of students, right? New courses in law schools. You have professionals who invest in their careers in a particular domain. So starting to break down sort of what are the implications of this is important. Another aspect of it, I think, central to the WTO is it creates new accountability mechanisms, which are transnational accountability mechanisms. Of course, the WTO is famous for not having much negotiating of new agreements since 1995. But in terms of committee meetings and in terms of governing those particular agreements, there are thousands of committee meetings every year. Right, every day there's multiple committee meetings, and the people, of course, U.S. and European Union fly in their bureaucrats into these particular meetings, and so you see that they involve peer review, they involve having to explain yourself in these committees, and so it's a form of governance, it's a new form of accountability mechanism, but it also comes, of course, with a normative frame. So one has to think then about and of course these officials are what I would call intermediaries. They're between the international and the national. They all have positions in national governments. And when you start to see sort of the impact of WTO law, just to speak to give a further example of it, the USTR has a dual role in the United States, and your commission has the trade directorate has a dual role in Europe. One, it defends and brings cases and represents Europe and the United States abroad, but they also oversee what's happening at the domestic level in terms of compliance. Right? So they're also what you could be considered as a trusty buddy of the WTO, even if they may fight each other at the international level. Right? They also bring these norms home. And just to give one empirical evidence of this, which I think is quite fascinating, they created an advisory center on WTO law in Geneva to help developing countries be represented in WTO disputes, because if they don't even have offices in Geneva, or if they don't have the league, they're not repeat players in litigation, so they don't invest in building domestic legal expertise, it becomes, in a sense, a repeat player. But when you look at when they did a report where the percentage of questions, and they get many, many questions in developing countries around the world, around a third of them are about their own compliance with their WTO obligations. Right? So it also, in a sense, and of course it has intermediaries. So you see, it becomes much more complicated than what we would traditionally think of in terms of WTO law. I offer all of this because as a starting point, as sort of reflexive thinking, because of course there's no one way to theorize transnational legal ordering. There's no Archimedean point which is going to provide us with a totalizing understanding, right, of the world. We all inevitably have starting points, be it from private law, public law, private international law, public international law. And the idea is to try to spur dialogue regarding what we can learn from each other in terms of conceptualizations, empirics, and evaluation of these processes. I like to always start with a question which my former colleague Stuart McCauley always would start whenever you had a project as a young academic, which is the question, so what? And so what, because he was also a jazz enthusiast, is the first song and the leading jazz album of all time by Miles Davis, Kind of Blue. And I hope in theorizing about transnational legal ordering we'll get us engaged, but not just leave us kind of blue. But Macaulay always asked that question. Of course, the so what question, just to give a couple of examples of why this all matters, that clearly in terms of globalization writ large, or just give an economic globalization, but we know in communication networks and technology and so forth. But just in terms of amount of economic activity, in 1980, global capital flows about $400 million a year. It rose to $3.7 trillion in 2000, and $11 trillion, over a quarter of global GDP. Then it plummeted, right, during the financial crisis. And then a year after, in 2009, to $1.8 trillion, and then more than doubled in a year by bouncing back in 2010 and so forth. And with the shift in sort of global economic power, of course, the U.S. and Europe have declined in terms of global economic power by 10% in the last 10 years, which is pretty remarkable. Surely we're going to see capital flows. We already see them, and it's predicted increasingly going to see them coming from more than not just the global north, but now from emerging economies. Couple that with, of course, the famous figures, and I understand from Andrew that Thomas Piketty happens to be in town, of the rise of global inequality. So just to give a figure in the United States, or two figures, one, 3% of the United States own 54% of household income in the United States. And we know globalization processes are part of that. So it's remarkable. Over half of wealth is owned by 3% of the population. And in terms of 0.1% of the population owns the same amount of wealth as the bottom 90% of the population. So these figures now are commonly known. But they certainly, trying to understand these transnational legal processes and get a grip of them, I think is quite important. In terms of the globalization of law, one can look at many different dynamics in part of this globalization. The reach of national law and extraterritoriality as nation states extend their legal norms to govern transnational activity, raising, of course, all sorts of normative concerns, especially when it's the United States applying its norms to the world. And so how do we discipline that? But at the same time, perhaps it's necessary, right, in order to try to address issues which are not being otherwise addressed through international law. Conflicts of law. It used to be the supposition that everybody went to the United States to sue in the United States. But increasingly, you see conflicts of law suits being in four jurisdictions around the world. In grappling this, at least this is my understanding from my colleague Chris Wytok, who does empirical work in this area. Rise of arbitration. It's said commonly, empirically, it's a question, right, that 90% of contracts have arbitration clauses. Whatever it is, it's a lot of contracts, right, a large percentage. And Alex Stone Swede says that we now have over 200 stable arbitration centers around the world where you can go. And this, of course, is covering not just commercial activity in the United States. It's covering public law issues where they're raised in commercial disputes, antitrust law, securities law. It's also being extended to consumer law. When I click on buying something, I agree to arbitration. Employment law contracts, a very famous a case which is startling and challenging, but it shows how an employment case involving the Carnival cruise ships in the United States. They employ their basically foreign workers. They operate out of Texas, and then they take you down to the Gulf of Mexico, and thousands of maybe millions of Americans go every year. These are huge ships, and the employment contracts are all entitled international commercial contract. Right? It's and these are all foreigners, right? So they are not Americans, the famous case before the Fifth Circuit in the United States involved an Eastern European who broke her spine when there was a mishap on the ship, and she tried to bring a case before Texas court, which is where she lived in Galveston, Texas, working in Carnival Cruise. But she was told no, she had to litigate in London here before a sole arbitrator who was appointed for and paid by Carnival Cruise. And she also had to use the Carnival Cruise's doctor, who was paid by Carnival Cruise. And that was all recognized by the Fifth Circuit as an international commercial contract in the New York Convention. So it's a privatization of law through contract and through dispute settlement, but involves, of course, the state, its recognition, and its complicity in these processes. We see the rise of international courts. Karen Alter talks about 24 international courts that we have today, 21 with automatic jurisdiction in particular domains, which is thought of as unheard of 30 years ago. The rise of international soft law, guidelines, model laws across so many domains of law. Private lawmaking, which we'll get to, across domains of law. And, of course, technology, which is very difficult to govern within a national jurisdiction. So e-commerce, how do you govern e-commerce? And you see the Internet. And we see the rise of private legal systems to address them. And this is all central, of course, because law is a central component for social ordering. And it's very difficult, in my view, not very practical, to think about issues of justice or injustice until you have some sort of basic institutionalized social order. So then once you see this institutionalized takes place, we raise these questions, normative questions, about evaluating and critiquing them. Scholars, of course, are doing this. This is a fascinating set of statistics that I saw recently trying to come to grips with this. So there are now today over 50 journals with the title Transnational Law or Legal in the title. That's amazing. And if you do transnational or global law and legal, it rises to over 120 journals. Those are just legal journals, right? Or journals on transnational law and legal. In terms of scholarship, in terms of titles with transnational law or legal in the title, in 1990, there were 61 articles with the title. Today, I did a search, it was 1,644 articles. 60 to 1,644, right? In 25 years. In terms of content, the content rose from 400 articles in 1990 to around 20,000, right, in the last count, so that same database. Now, these issues, of course, of transnational law and legal ordering are incredibly controversial domestically. We see this in recent elections that just took place, the rise of populist parties and populist politicians, such as in the United States. Why? Because law traditionally, conventionally, in our minds, is tied to national law. Our most famous legal theorist, Oliver Wendell Holmes, said the story of law is the story of a nation's construction. If you go to see the courthouses in many European countries, you'll see, for instance, in Denmark when I was there, you look at the courthouse from 1820s, and it says the inscription underneath in the tympanum above the pillars, "With law we shall construct the land." Right. So it's this sense that it's part of our identity. In other words, it's part of a construction of who we are and where we belong. And so I think this is the reason why it's so controversial in the United States when judges cite foreign legal opinions, right? That somehow seems not a part of, it seems foreign or alien, or they're bringing something in which represents a loss of control, right? A loss of who we are. But I also think that it's inexorable, right? Given societal complexity and the transnational and global crises and problems that we face today. So just to give a couple of examples in intellectual property law. Intellectual property law under the WIPO conventions was primarily national. They were talking before 1995, and it was all about you could have whatever patent law that you wanted. You just couldn't discriminate, right, in terms of what you applied, but what you called a patent was up for you. And there was a sense of also creating sort of a more policy space for developing countries within the WIPO discourse at the time. And then suddenly you get the World Trade Organization, the TRIPS Agreement, this framing, right, of intellectual property and discourse as a trade issue, which is now accepted today. You see it proliferating through all new agreements. And so that shift in framing suddenly created a major shift in seeing this as a transnational problem, whereas before it was up to different nation states. In parallel to that, the economic, social, and cultural right to health, 1990s, it was not much formed there in terms of what sort of obligation states had to their citizens. And still, of course, it's very controversial in the United States, but you see an incredible normative development since then in terms of, and also then moving into the World Health Organization, so that states now have responsibilities for the health of their citizens. And these, of course, two legal orders are in tension and conflict with each other, but at the same time, you can see them both in parallel reducing the policy space of national governments who have to recognize patents and have to use whatever scarce resources they have to provide for the health of their citizens. Right? So you see sort of this transnational layering of areas that did not take place before. And you can see this across all areas of law is the argument. So to turn to these three different modes of theorizing, first in terms of transnationalist private law, you see this the first part of it, I'm going to break it into three subparts. The first part is, you can see it in law and economics theorizing, of in terms of lex mercatoria, in terms of private lawmaking, which in terms of the efficiency and optimality of private legal ordering, as opposed to the cost of state-based ordering, the cost of litigating conflict of law issues under state law. And you see this reflected in the developments of international arbitration, which I just referenced. And it's a form of decentered lawmaking, as they would argue, involved. But they even go further. So Gillian Hatfield, which is looking at the need to create competing private law regimes that you can select as a company, right? The problem is not just to have one, but competing ones, and that then you can create a market for law. Right, so it's all be market-based. Of creating different legal orders, you can select them, plug them into the contract, and then plug in which sort of dispute settlement forum you would want. And this seems to be, of course, is all competition and market-based, a much more efficient way to actually create standards and resolve disputes. But there's, of course, countervailing theory with respect to theorizing on the transnational. Directly opposed to this particular theorizing, which is looking at private legal orders as regulatory orders. Most of these theorists go back to Carl Polanyi and the need to embed markets socially in social systems. And you see this sort of empirical work across domains in terms of labor law and fair labor standards, environmental law, sustainable forestry, consumer protection law, sort of it's in e-commerce, you're creating new trust mark systems and online dispute settlement fora, and private certification devices, and then the removal or the potential for consumer boycotts or non-use, sort of private enforcement mechanisms. You see this in food safety law, Walmart as a global regulator through its contracts, or Sainsbury as a global regulator in terms of the standards that it requires that you meet for food safety. And so you see it across many different domains of law, and the argument is you see functional equivalence in private regulation that you also can see in public law in terms of creating the standards, in terms of certifiers who adjudicate whether or not you met the standard, and in terms of different enforcement devices, shaming, boycotting, and so forth. And of course, this does have all sorts of distributive effects, and so then you get complementary theorizing in terms of legitimacy and accountability of these different actors creating these different legal systems. But I should point out, from my own perspective, that much of this, that public law is linked to much of this. So to give an example, in terms of WTO law and sustainable forestry, one public international law in 1992 at the Rio Conference failed to come up with enforceable hard law sustainable forestry standards. At the same time, the GATT and the WTO place limits on the ability of states, or at least it was understood that, to regulate extraterritorially. So Austria, for example, which had an import ban on non-sustainably harvested timber, was threatened with a legal suit before the GATT by Indonesia and others because it was governing how the timber was produced, which was a matter of their own national sovereign decision-making. And Austria withdrew its import ban, but at the same time, it helped to fund the private systems of certification, which has given rise to the Forest Stewardship Council. But also, I think that if you want to look at the Forest Stewardship Council, which is then tied to retailers in the United States and Europe, if you want to buy lumber, right, you often see its mark on it. So it's a form of private legal ordering. But if you look on the ground in terms in Indonesia, in terms of the way to this, the Indonesian national law is still much more relevant, right, than this purely private realm. And so I think, and Tim Bartley and others have done work in terms of what's the layering and the interaction of national law, these transnational principles, as well as customary systems of land rights. A second countervailing theory comes from private international law theorists, Robert Y., Horatio Mirawat, and others, who want to look at the role of private international law not just as a sort of facilitator of private ordering, right, but actually as a regulatory mechanism that provides tools to address the interface of different national systems and creates what Christian Jurgis references as a mindset of we have different public orders, how do they interact, when does national law and national concepts of ordre public and of regulation stepped in to govern the international. And it becomes also, and so for these theorists, it's a form of pluralism, a form of cosmopolitanism, but also, notice, decentered, right, from global ordering. All of these techniques, of these particular theories, are circumscribed, they're more parsimonious than trying to look at transnational legal ordering as I do, as the interaction of public and private international law. And I think they're key components of decentering analysis just from the state and so forth. But I think that they're only partial in terms of trying to understand the flow and of legal norms that govern us today. The second group looks at transnational law in methodological terms to reconstruct what we think of law. All theorists do this. So the law and economics theorists, they view that the essence of law is a set of rules that characterized by legal attributes such as generality and universality, an authoritative steward for removing ambiguities and adapting the rules to changing circumstances. That's Hatfield and Weingast. Once you look at law in those terms, of course, it can be pure private. The steward can be a private body. Enforcement can be decentralized through private mechanisms. Okay? Similar private law regulatory theorists show how regulatory norms can be created by civil society and other private actors involving functional equivalents of lawmaking, adjudication, and enforcement. The second group, though, I believe, tries to go deeper in looking at not this sort of functional equivalence in law as a thing, but in terms of this conceptual theorizing, using the construct of the transnational to rethink what we mean by law. So Pears and Banson at King's College, for example, is in this particular category of looking at how does in law, in a functionally differentiated world, how do we think of it? And he posits the metaphor of rough consensus and running code, is that we think about the way law is governed in transnational space today as involving taking from the internet the development of a consensus as to norms and then a running code of how they're changed over time. And you see Gunter Teubner in systems theory also trying to reconceptualize law in terms of purely non-state terms, in reflexive type terms, And driven, all of these, I think, are by a normative impulse, not purely a sort of conceptual one, and that is a sense that the state is losing capacity to govern. And so we need to rethink our construct of law and this particular situation that we face. And his student, Paul Kajer, also sort of moves to thinking of this transnational as sort of these issue-specific, functionally differentiated organizations, fair laboring, international standards organization, and so forth. But he also complements it with, we need to reconceptualize what we mean by the political. And there he says that what's being replaced by what we think of as the public space or the nation state, right, the constitution, we now think in terms of stakeholders, in terms of transparency, right, in terms of reason giving. And it's a very different logic. It's not a normative logic, right, which comes out of nation-based lawmaking, but rather it's a much more managerial, cognitive type construct of what governs transnational lawmaking today. So finally, let me say a little bit about what we're trying to do with transnational legal ordering. Is this third subset. And we look at transnational legal ordering as this process of construction and flow of norms, involving, in Boa Santos's words, both globalized localisms, U.S. law being projected globally across many different domains, and globalized globalisms. That is, how is our transnational international norms translated, hybridized, applied in practice, locally abroad. And we see, and Sally Mary, who's done a lot of this work and has a chapter in our book, looking at then different sites, right, of lawmaking. So on the one hand, you have the lawmaking in terms of setting women's rights standards at global conferences on women's rights. And then you have it at the very local level in terms of what sort of framing will work given the cultural constructs and power dynamics within local levels so that these transnational norms will take. Right? And so it's that interaction, but that interaction involves mapping the middle, right? Who are the intermediaries? And I think in many areas of law, you'll find that the intermediaries are not that numerous, right? Who bring these law homes, who, so that on finance law or banking law, right, they hold positions of power within their national systems, right? They represent the national systems, and they're heads of bar associations or sections of bar associations in a very technical domain. So it's these intermediaries who become crucial. And of course, nation states, their power dynamics within them. So these intermediaries, they can use the transnational for domestic projects involving political contests in domestic spheres. And so in the transnational legal ordering project, what we try to do is, from empirical study across domains of human rights, business law, and regulatory law, we try to build new hypotheses, new theories. So just to give an example, the processes of transnational legal ordering involves framing issues, emergence of orders, propagating orders, contesting orders, institutionalizing orders, nesting orders, resisting them, structuring them, and also studying their decline. So framing becomes central, right? And this is a role for any legal scholar. That across the discourses and frames of transnational legal orders are integral to their study. They involve ideologies. They involve priors, which are often taken for granted and not studied. Often the role of transnational legal ordering will involve aspirational, open-ended, soft law norms. And then the question, such as financial stability. But then financial stability is given meaning, right, through things like the IMF and World Bank technical assistance projects, or what are called ROSCs, which will have very detailed recommendations of reforming business, corporate, and financial systems in countries around the world. Or, for example, in the chapter in our book, Sally Mary looks at you can have very open-ended human rights standards, but then they're given, they need to be measured in terms of compliance. So actors create indicators. And with those indicators, right, it then suddenly, these relatively soft law norms have measurement devices. And for those who report to want to have good report cards with respect to those indicators, that has an incredible impact on how they, and sort of the different ways that they try to implement human rights obligations. And so you see this sort of soft form of governing becoming, in her terms, hardened through these particular devices. Framing becomes central in any endeavor. So let's take human trafficking law. Human trafficking law, you often see serially attempts to try to use different frames to try to figure out which can be most effective. So Beth Simmons in the book looks at how you could... There was one frame for human trafficking law, which with respect to migration flows. We know how controversial migration flows are in governing those, right? States don't like to be told what to do in terms of governing migration flows. Another way to thinking about human trafficking is human rights law. Right? Human rights law also imposes obligations on states. Right? So what frame actually took, and this was studied through discourse analysis to see what discourse became triumphant. And the discourse, they tied human trafficking law towards a broader discourse, which was criminal law. And of course, criminal law is a frame which both protects state sovereignty and empowers the executive department. And so if the human trafficking as a legal ordering system was going to take, right, it looked for a particular frame, and actors looked for a particular frame to try to enroll states to engage with it, as they have. Frames, of course, are important in terms of contesting how we conceptualize a problem. Transnational legal ordering is all about solving problems, but the problems are not natural. They're not out there. They're framed. They're understood in particular ways, and there can be competition in terms of how to frame the problem. Right? And that's much of the politics. It's where the politics starts in terms of transnational legal ordering is the framing. So Larry Helfer's chapter in the book looks at the frames in terms of access to medicines. Is this an intellectual property issue or is this a human rights issue? How do these frames interact? Do they they certainly contradict each other. Does this framing mean that each of the legal orders is somehow blocked, or potentially are both of the legal orders just in parallel operate to provide new obligations and new sense of norms and accountability norms within states? Or I think of Leif Wehner's work, right, in terms of blood oil. Which framing is going to work for the idea that our complicity in buying oil from states which are governed in a non-democratic way by elites who strip the natural resources from the citizens, what frame's going to work if that is going to be taken as a transnational issue as opposed to one of simply recognizing the national state, nation state property and contract law? What's going to take? So emergence of transnational legal orders are not linear, they're not uncontroversial, they're not inexorable. They're not just from above, they're often globalized localisms. They often fail. So to give an example, it's important to study failure as well as successes, right? So in food safety, there's a chapter in the book where Tim Butta looks at 30 years ago, there were four transnational legal organizations for food safety, right, which had different actors, different interlocutors, different geographical scope, different legal scope, but only one Codex Alimentarius became dominant. The story is how, right? What's the mechanism that this one emerged and the other three failed? The other, in terms of these emergence of transnational legal orders, is that these are processes where the creation of one transnational legal order can have unintended effects, right? Leading to new problems. So there's a chapter on tax law, you know, central to the sovereignty of the state, in which a transnational legal order with respect to the avoidance of double taxation emerged out of a system of model contracts developed through the OECD to govern taxation throughout the world. And it was one way for developed countries, the global north, to ensure their tax base vis-a-vis developing countries. But accountants, as well as many developing countries, responded to this. And they created tax havens, and they created new tax avoidance mechanisms. And suddenly now today, because of this incredibly successful transnational legal order, you have this sense of the need to create a new transnational legal order, not to govern harmful tax competition. And the question will be, will they be able to accomplish this? But to look at how the first transnational legal order's impact, you have to look at the professionals who worked within it, right, to then create new challenges. Propagating transnational legal orders, the dynamics of propagating them to multiple nation states become central. So how does this work? And there are many different mechanisms. So looking at the particular mechanisms becomes important. So in intellectual property law, you know, there's this nexus now of bilateral agreements, right, which the United States is using to try to propagate its norms around the world. But at the same time, what you see right now is a very interesting regime shift, because in a sense, for the architects, sort of the brilliant architects, some of them who were individuals as well as trade associations to link intellectual property to the WTO trade regime, there's a sense of failure because not enough cases are being brought to discipline developing countries. So the newest move is to privatize dispute settlement through investor state dispute settlement, where private parties can bring claims and enforce, in a sense, WTO public international law obligations before before an arbitral process. And we'll see this move now is we're starting to see new cases, and it's a fascinating new move, which of course involves legal professionals and so forth. And all of these professionals become central to this construction of transnational legal orders, and in particular legal professionals. If you look at the governance of maritime transport, you see the specialists on the Comité Maritime International who meet and create these global standards. If you look at data privacy norms, you need to look at data privacy professionals who write manuals, codes of conduct, work within internet organizations and so forth. You look at government council, corporate councils, and academics. And civil society actors, of course, are obstructors of some transnational legal norms and also promoters of others, human trafficking, right, the accountability of leaders for gross human rights violations. These are all contingent, right, processes. So you can see certain mechanisms being very successful over a period of time, and suddenly there'll be sort of a politicization of an issue, such as for financial regulation, which looked like you could have technocratic specialists meeting in Basel and so forth, but once it hits the U.S. Congress, it becomes very much more difficult to actually try to govern these issues, which looked like there was a trajectory. And of course, shift in global market power also makes it much more difficult for U.S. expertise to dominate this particular transnational legal order. And in terms of propagating transnational legal orders, it becomes a fascinating issue. Is it better to use precise norms or sort of vague, open-ended norms, right? John Braithwaite, who's one of my heroes and sort of in both as an activist and as a theoretician, argues that what you want is you want it to focus on broad principles. If you start arguing about the technical details, civil society organizations are going to lose. You want to set the frame, right? You want to think about the broader principles. Whereas many legal theorists talk about, the importance of precision. In fact, if you look at the legalization project, the very definition of hard law, this is a special issue of international organization, precision was one of the attributes that made something hard and more binding and more dependable. Contesting TLOs, transnational legal orders, they often involve conflicts, contests between different legal orders. One legal order's success can create incentives to try to create a rival legal order. You also see competition between different norm makers for primacy. And so which ones becomes dominant? One of the issues I think that becomes central in trying to understand transnational legal ordering is the issue of legitimacy. So after the Asian financial crisis for bankruptcy law, the United States tried to enroll the IMF and the World Bank to export its legal norms to the world. But there was a sense that even though these are very powerful organizations, the IMF, developing country can be dependent on financing and so forth, they were viewed as illegitimate. And so norm-making actually migrated to a UN organization, UNCITRAL, creating model codes, because there was a sense that if you were going to get these countries to actually engage in the process and bring it home, you needed an organization where you brought them in as participants in the norm-making process so they would buy into it, or at least those who were the core professionals in that domain. And so mapping transnational legal orders becomes a fascinating exercise in terms of spatiality and legal geography, that there are clearly boundaries to transnational legal orders in terms of legal boundaries, which you can look at in terms of their ideologies, in terms of their discourse, in terms of the actor perceptions, and in terms of their alliances and contests. And you can see what we insist in terms of understanding, and you can see this in terms of legally, in terms of legal families, lineages, models. You can see them temporally in terms of rising and falling, settling and unsettling, and their decline. And so what we insist in this project is to really understand the transnational legal order, you need to move beyond the international or the transnational, because that doesn't constitute a transnational legal order, and it's not what the norm promoters are interested in, and in any case. It's easier to do in terms of a legal scholarship, but it's not the actual interest. What you really need, and you also need to look at more than compliance in terms of national codification. You ultimately are interested in local legal practice, the creation of a new normal, an understanding in terms of what everyday lawyers give advice to their clients, right? It's this interaction between the international, transnational, the national and local practice, which creates in an ideal type terms a fully fledged transnational legal orders. So what I hope there is to have conveyed is that there's no theoretical approach from some Archimedean standpoint that explains all this. Each provides conceptual lenses for seeing the world in particular ways, and thus contributing to social action in the world in light of such viewpoint. Each of them is important, and each is partial. But such theoretical work helps generate new empirical study, which is, in my view, should be a goal of theory. And such empirical study can recursively lead to the refinement of theory. And so we go on, and in doing so, perhaps change the way things are. Thank you.
Thank you, Greg. So there's a whole bunch there for us to get our teeth into. So can I ask for comments and questions and thoughts and reflections? Yeah, go on.
Okay, thank you. So I'm just thinking about this idea of framing and the whole idea of how everything gets mediated. So our choices are just sort of drawing on a number of things you said. What stands out for me is this idea of mediation. So framing circumscribes our choices. It circumscribes our options. It circumscribes the means through which we can contest what's happening. It provides the language within which we function. It makes me think of the literature on expert knowledge, right? How what we receive is mediated through expert knowledge, and really the rejection, in fact, of expert knowledge, not just with the more recent stuff, but Bill Easterly, but going back on the sort of critiques of development and economic development. Mm-hmm. So this whole idea of mediation, we see the World Bank as a good example. The World Bank doesn't lend that much money, but it's extremely powerful. It's powerful because it provides the knowledge, allegedly, and so forth. Okay, so we have this, to me, the idea of framing, and I realize it's, or no doubt it's more complex than that, really speaks to me about this whole dimension of mediation. And so what I'm thinking about, and it sort of links to some things I'm working through in my own writing, is about whether, under conditions, under economic globalization, global capitalism, neoliberalism, kind of for centuries, global neoliberalism, is there a pre-framing? Is there something that happens before those decisions are made, before that framing, that legal regime, that language, that mechanism, that coming together of different legal regimes to construct them? Does all that happen based on certain biases and assumption derived of the way in which the terms under which we advance and embrace the global order? So biases around efficiency, around growth, around the benefit and of markets, around competition. So how do these dimensions pre-frame what we think is framing and pre-mediate the mediation, which is already, in a sense, circumscribing what we can do?
Okay. So I see them all as part of the framing process, right? So because there's, we always have a starting point, right? We never start from a blank slate. And so the argument on sort of neoliberalism and the economization of everything is that that becomes a new normal, right? Which then in any particular, so I take it by what you mean by pre-framing in this particular context, is that we, if, to the extent that this, there's a, if, there's this major shift, right, in terms of the way we see the world, in terms of individuals as opposed to social solidarity, in terms of everything is economized, in terms of what's the most efficient way to govern, that these are sort of, in a sense, meta-norms, right, that shape the way we perceive any particular problem. I think there's certainly an aspect to that, which is quite powerful, but of course we know this is also contested. And so I think you would have to look down into particular different domains. So I think that is a major meta-norm that you can see across many different areas. And certainly another one might be measurement, which is in terms of trying to measure everything, which is, again, a sort of managerial type of impetus, which is being applied across all most domains of social life. But there's clearly a politics to framing, and so how do we conceive of? And there's also, and part of it is what's going to be more effective. So it could be that what you're referencing is to be more effective to get actors to take up a particular framing for human trafficking or for the accountability of political leaders, or for bankruptcy norms you have to you end up tying into this. But of course, you know, all the work that's coming out contesting those particular frames, that's also part of the process. And I don't think, I mean, there's clearly, if you even talk to people in the World Bank and so forth, for their there's a lot of contestation going on in terms of those very, what you conceptualize as pre-frames. So if you need in this whole concept of the Washington consensus and the post-Washington consensus and the Beijing and the post-Beijing consensus and so forth, I think that's all shifting. I don't think it's set. I think it's dynamic and it's contested and it's part of the contest which go in the process of framing. And in terms, in framing, of course, is also not just about, it's not just about the solution to a problem. It's identifying and naming a problem, right? And so part of what you described is the solution to a problem. But before you can even start devising a solution, one has to, there's a question of what do we see as a problem which we may have never thought of before as a social problem, right? And I think in many areas of social life, you see this happening all the time, right? Yeah.
Two short questions. You spoke a lot about the WTO.
Yep.
And I wonder how you see the role of the WTO in the governance of sustainable development. And second question is a topic that you didn't talk about, and that is energy as a transnational issue, which, as I see it, is fragmented, disjointed. We
Well, in terms of the first question, I mean, the WTO is a minor part, right, of sustainable development. I think in terms of thinking the way there's many other actors, I think there's it could be, and the concern is that it's a constraint in different initiatives on sustainable development. My own personal view is that there's a lot of social, there's been, of course, a huge amount of social contestation about this. And I think it's actually had, to the extent that WTO officials, right, and decision makers operate under a certain logic, right, which is a trade-based logic, right, in which trade liberalization is the governing framing discourse, right, that there has been a significant pushback, at least in terms of sustainable development issues. And so you see, as many have written, the sense that we need to, one, bring other organizations into the committee work on trade and environment, for example, other international organizations, UNEP and so forth. They send the WTO out to those other international organizations as well to talk to them about trade law norms. But I think that our challenge is, I think the WTO will, one, I think at least the dispute settlement system has become sort of much softer and will be much softer in terms of, I think, for example, I've said many times that, and I wrote in the Journal of Transnational Environmental Law here, edited here by Veer, that if the U.S. or Europe acted unilaterally on climate change to create a system to block imports or to have a tax on imports that would equalize what they tax their own greenhouse gas emissions, that would survive a WTO challenge. If it didn't, of course, then there would be a major blockage of the WTO in terms of national decision making to try to create a system of to internalize the externalities of carbon emissions. But I don't see the WTO as a major problem. I think it's the willingness of states to take action themselves. And I think if climate change is going to be addressed, it's going to be what Dan Badansky in the book talks about, different microprocesses of developing carbon emission systems, of emission system for maritime, which Europe tried to do it, is trying to do it through air transport and so forth. And it'll be the combination of different domains that may lead to some impetus in terms of actually trying to address that particular issue. In terms of energy, I mean, there's many different aspects of energy, from the way it's transported to the way it's governed. I would invite trying to use a conceptual framework that looks at framing, propagating particular norms, institutionalizing them. It's going to be a dichotomic process. It can't just, you'll look at competing norms. And it may be, if you say it's very fragmented now, it's who are the competing actors? Is it a regional, do you see competing regional framings? How is norm, do you see certain subdomains where work is taking place compared to a totalizing frame for all of energy? And that would be the way, anyway, I would want to try to approach it, working with somebody in that particular area.
Thanks. I really enjoyed that. I actually want to ask two questions, if I could. One is, I'm still grappling with this concept of transnational legal order, which is the large issue. Yeah. I mean, in international political economy, which is the field in which I work in, for a long time we've been talking about international regimes, which were defined sort of as sort of the principles, norms,
right,
regulations,
right,
and rules that structure,
yeah,
interaction between states and non-states in given issue areas.
Yeah.
Are international regimes and transnational legal orders the same thing?
Yeah.
And the other question simply is, where in this analysis of transnational legal order is power? It seems to be sort of implicit in almost everything you said,
yeah,
but the word actually, at least I spaced out, was sort of not there. I'm trying to, where,
Yeah, so it's everywhere. The first, you know, to answer the second question first, power is instantiated in law, right? In terms of law, it's a form of meaning, right? Which it can be viewed as power. So if you're looking at sort of different faces of power from the material actors, this particular theory, there's agency, right? There are actors. There's actors, be them states, United States. When we say the United States is trying to globalize its norms, clearly there's a form of material power. Institutionalization in terms of framing of how do we even conceive or what's on the agenda, what's not on the agenda, that's a form of power. In terms of laws, a system of meeting where you take things, creating a new normal in terms of norms of appropriateness, that's a form of power. In terms of legal ordering in relation to other forms of social ordering, it's a form of violence, and that, you know, because law has a system of coercion, right, backed by enforcement. So I think power is central to you can't think about transnational legal ordering outside of power. And so it was implicit in what we're saying, but we talk about power explicitly also in the book. In terms of regime theory, in the first chapter of the book, we have a little subsection on regime theory and try to differentiate. It's clearly there's certain, we've learned a lot and borrowed from, and I've certainly learned a lot from regime theory. I would say that at least for us, and go back to at least early critics of regime theory, is sort of looking at these regimes at the top, right? We theorized, or I didn't talk too much as much about it, this sort of theory of recursivity, that norms, we're looking at the flow of norms, both top down, bottom up, and the importance in terms of local practice ultimately. And so that there's no regime in terms of transnational, in the theory of transnational legal ordering, unless there's some sort of concordance of norms, some sort of settled concordance of norms at the international, transnational, national, and level of local practice. So those are at least two areas where I think we differ or go beyond or build from, perhaps the best word, regime theory.
There were two questions. One, and then there was also a second
question. I found the presentation very interesting. I have three short questions. The first one regarding system theory of Teubner and Riemann. Mm-hmm. You mentioned Teubner, and of course his notion on the book of Wieler goes back to Ehrlich. But Ehrlich, as I understood it, talks about there being a legal or social order before the state. And so, because you mentioned that now the state isn't able to govern anymore.
Yes.
And now Teubner comes in. So my question would be, how do you theorize legal or social order which were there actually before the state law came into force in this region?
Yes.
This would be the first question. Yeah. The second one would be towards Mary's intermediates. And you mentioned his intermediates.
Towards what, I'm sorry?
Intermediates.
The intermediaries, yeah.
The actors in the middle.
Yes, yeah.
You mentioned these intermediates as being quite powerful, but as Mary describes them as well as quite vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
So I would be interested how you would remark on that notion that they're not so powerful when you look and that's practice because they, as well, they are depending on financial resources, mm-hmm. because they're all quite often activist and NGOs.
Yeah.
And the third question, in the last part you mentioned this different legal orders competing,
yes.
and that we need to find out which order is legitimate. And there, do you have something in mind how to define which order is the most legitimate? Would that go in the direction of, how mass deliberation theory on defining or reducing the influence?
Okay, so I'll try to repeat the three questions. And so the first one is with respect, repeat the first one again, just to Teubner and Ehrlich. Yes. So I'm not being a systems theorist, I'm an outsider, but I think that there's always forms a different social ordering. So the question is, do we construct those as law or not? I think I think certainly Zumbanson and Teubner. Zumbanson, I know more in terms of how he places himself in terms of legal pluralism. But it's a starting point. Clearly, is that you can have legal ordering or have law outside the nation state. The move, which I think both of them make in terms of systems theory, is that we live in a very different world today, which is a functionally differentiated world, which is involving different systemic logics, which is a very different type of legal pluralism than local social ordering. Cagère actually, I think, does a very good job in his own, is saying that we can now think about three different, using systems theory, three different types of logic. One is traditional stratificatory sort of social ordering, which can be viewed in sort of law in an Ehrlich-type sense, right, local social norms. The second would be territorial-based state law, and a third would be this transnational functionally differentiated law. And so, at least for Cagère, he actually looks at this layering of legal ordering, positing what you described as a third layer. Whereas I think my reading of Zum Banzen, but he's out of town, is that it's more of an inspiration about how to think about, in terms of legal pluralism, as this interacting of multiple legal orders, including purely non-state-based ones.
Thanks for a great talk. So just to take up this idea of the need to embed markets in social systems, I mean, clearly that does bring issues of consent and power to the fore.
Yes.
And, you know, I'm struck talking with colleagues who work in private law, contracting or financial securities or sovereign debt swap. They often say, well, governance doesn't intrude on what we do. In fact, actually, governance as a phrase doesn't help us very much. You know, issues of parity or whatever don't speak to what we're working on. And I do wonder whether, you know, we do need to distinguish task environments or strategic environments across these different kinds of substantive governance domains. And you and Mark Pollock have made that very helpful critique of the strong cooperation narrative that informs a lot of legal scholarship. You've proposed recentering the focus on distributive effects, which I think is really important. And it seems that this would be particularly acute when law intrudes upon public goods provision. So picking up the issue of, say, TTIP and the private investment settlement dispute mechanisms, it seems to me that clearly that is going to confront, as you put it, domestic configurations of power. Is there a certain myopia on the part of these legal professionals, these non-entrepreneurs, around the, you know, intruding upon the democratic social contract in this way? Do we see evidence of TTIP trying to embed itself within a social system of legitimacy? Will democratic states be forced to withdraw their consent? I mean, what do you think might be on the horizon?
Okay. I see two questions there. One is on private international law theorists, and the second is on TTIP, right? I mean, I think the move, and not being a private international law specialist, I think the move is within private international law to critique those who see private international law as not involving distributive issues and not involving regulatory ones. And so they're trying to introduce the concept of regulation as an ordering device, and that private international law should be seen in those terms as well. A person who comes from public law, I would want to push further in terms of, well, that sounds like an important move in terms of how we think about private international law. And part of it is a pushback for developments in private international law of simply being, of reducing the issue of the role of public national law in assessing contracts and arbitration and so forth. And so it's to re-empower state-based public law within a private international law construct. So that's the way I read Robert Y and many others, right? So they're actually within the private international law discipline having their own debate. And I think they view themselves as a minority within it, okay? But they're having their own debate within that discipline. There is a broader issue where they are making a claim that private international law should instruct the way we think about public international law, because private international law is a decentralized as opposed to a centralized global form of governance, which is much more pluralist. But at the same time that it's pluralist, it also has cosmopolitan concepts in terms of how do we govern interaction between colliding legal orders. So that's the way I see them. In terms of TTIP, first of all, of course, TTIP is one of the major chapters about regulatory transparency, but of course it's a totally non-transparent process to determine the norms for transparency as part of the problem. So we don't know what it says. We know who the different, many of the different proponents are. They're quite clear, and there are many conferences and so forth, mainly in Washington and Brussels. What's quite fascinating, it's completely below the radar screen in the United States. So I gave inaugural lecture at Irvine on TTIP and TPP, and I showed a slide, first of Berlin, where there are 50,000 people marching in the street, and then in Washington, D.C., of 8 protesters with a sign, right? And so it's just a very different political dynamic right now. And actually, I just heard someone, I was just in Washington, D.C., unfortunately, at a conference for the American Society of International Law, and a practitioner said to me, well, thank goodness trade is underneath the radar screen, right? And so it's probably all going to go through. My own view is I've always, I'm not against transatlantic governance. I think there's a real role in terms of trying to mediate these different systems. My hope would be is not just to involve trade officials in a deregulatory agenda to try to purely remove trade barriers, but also to bring regulators together in a form of governance where they engage with each other, reassess their own regulations in light of the impacts of their regulations in terms of their both trade but also their public policy objectives. And I think there's some potential for that, and that's the way I would see the importance of transatlantic governance. But that's it's clearly not the agenda of many of those who are behind pushing for the process. And so how it will come out, we'll see the text, right, when they're signed. I don't think I'm not very confident that TTIP will actually be signed because of all the processes in Europe, these are two relatively powerful actors. They're hard to push each other around. And so they won't get as much as what they want. At least their stakeholders won't. And because of that, they won't be as happy of buying into a process which their norms are less likely to be exported than in other negotiations. Yeah.
Yes. Yes, thank you for a very interesting lecture. My academic discipline is not law, it is international relations. I'm a senior lecturer there. But as you know, we are also very occupied with international order, although we approach the questions differently. Well, what I have been working quite much with is the principle called responsibility to protect, which shortly means that the international community has taken the responsibility to protect populations against mass atrocities if the state cannot or will not do so. Well, what I'm concerned about is why is this so difficult to implement? And I was thinking about what you said about precise norms, yes, vague, open-ended norms. When you talk about the precise norm, do you then mean one which does not only specify what is to be obtained, but which also specifies which actors are going to do what? Because if that is a necessity for calling a norm a precise one, then it is extremely much more difficult to reach a sort of implementation instead of a general agreement about the principle.
Yeah.
But that does not lead necessarily to any kind of implementation, because the quarrel starts just after the general event. Shortly, a question then. Is it better to structure debates to conceptualize or to make the conceptualizing process going to begin with a vague open-ended norms by the hope that it will generate anything more? Or What is your opinion?
It's an empirical question, right? And I wrote with a political scientist on the responsibility to protect, sort of moving away from my area of, which is Mark Pollack, who I've written with a number of times. And we did it in terms of looking at hard and soft law and their roles. And so the way I would think about this is I would start that the responsibility to protect is a framing soft law move to upset a settled legal order in the UN Charter with respect to Article 2.7 and the nations, you know, have sovereignty and you will not interfere in their internal affairs. And there were norm entrepreneurs coming up with a new concept, right? Responsibility to protect. And it's developed through sort of a Canadian sort of exercise with an Australian, right, who took this up. And you actually see individuals, right, and sort of not powerful states, right, trying to shift these norms. And Kofi Annan takes this up. So you have a Secretary General of the United Nations. They have a report, was it, on our common future, right? And so you see these are non-binding norms. Now, whether or not they're successful is a different issue, but certainly you can see the process is sort of reframing, sort of upsetting. So in the article, one of our primary arguments is that hard and soft law are conventionally, in the political science and the legal discourse, were viewed as either alternatives. In a sense, you know, do you go with the soft law or do you go with the hard law norm, right, which is the second part of your question, or complements, right, is that, well, you know, you start with soft law, you get hard law, or, you know, you get hard law, but then you can elaborate it through more soft law. And we wrote the article, this is about, you know, hard law, soft law, alternative complements and antagonists, right? And so clearly this was a move to try to upset a legal order. And it's not easy to do that, right? Those are pretty strong norms that were instantiated following World War II and the Germany's invasion of Sudetenland and all the concerns about how the sort of protecting the rights of those in another state could be used as a pretext for all sorts of bad things can happen. And so this is an ongoing normative debate, right? Responsibility to protect. It clearly, they were not going to get hard law norms to start. Right? They couldn't get them. So maybe in some way soft law is the best they could get. But even doing that, right, we saw interventions that took place through the Security Council, a hard law organization. And so maybe you could say in certain contexts they were successful in major shifts in terms of how the Security Council operated for a period of time. I mean, even as recently as Libya, right? And of course, I think it's a dynamic process too, because you look what happened in Libya. There's some questioning, right, as to whether or not these norms can be used by, you give the United States an inch and suddenly it will interpret, you know, the particular resolution in a way that, you know, most people read it doesn't seem to say what they interpret it as. And they suddenly become much more interventionist in a conflict. And if you get a result, which is a migration crisis in Europe or otherwise, then there that norm of humanitarian intervention becomes in the question. And so it's a very, it's something which you need to look at its development through time. And part of it is, but by creating the norm, it's not as if there's one center, right, of where many different actors are going to try to use this norm, which will legitimize acts, and which either through the Security Council or otherwise, which were easier to critique, right, under previously existing international law.
Greg, can I ask a question about professionals, yeah, which you mentioned, yeah, a few times in your presentation, yeah, also in your work? Clearly, professional groups play a pretty important role, I think, in your understanding of transnational legal orders work, all the way from framing, propagation, all the rest.
Mm-hmm.
Your professionals, your rule of law professionals, your whatever. And I don't think you make the point directly that there are that that is something distinctive about transnational legal orders, but I think you could make that claim that there's something there's, that there, that professional groups or people who think of themselves primarily as professionals are playing a particularly important or central role in these legal orders.
Yeah.
And I wanted to ask you whether you thought that gave something distinctive to the dynamics of transnational legal orders. And I guess what I'm thinking of, I mean, there are many features of professional groups that are distinctive, but one of them is, you know, they do exercise the power, we do exercise the power that you describe, but always from a position which disavows being a decision maker. I mean, they don't think of themselves as decision makers. It's always advisors or implementers or whatever. So is there something about transnational legal orders which is governance by those who never think of themselves as decision makers, and whether that resonates with any of the studies that you've done?
Yeah. Well, I would say sometimes they, I would think they even go further, sometimes they are decision makers, right? So if an uni droit, right, you have, you know, private law specialists who are drafting norms, right, for the world in particular areas, and you know, securities master's agreements, you have professionals writing an ISDA, a particular form of agreement, right, which is to govern all contracts for derivatives around the world. So I think that they at times actually do see themselves as rulemakers. At other times, I think they're in the background, but it's just because of the forum. It depends on the forum. Right. So if you look at UNCITRAL norm making, it's state based and only states have voices, states have votes, but others speak and they engage with national representatives. In other areas, such as the World Trade Organization, only nation states speak, but they are engaging with private practitioners and businesses all the time, be it in disputes or committee work or outside the corridors and so forth. So I think you can see them as depending on the forum, right, and which also then depend on the substantive issue in different ways. But yes, private professionals are central to the analysis because why? Unlike regime theory, we really are focusing on processes, right, and then the different types of public and private actors participating in those processes. And so at these multiple levels. And so I think that's... So, yes, although the other theorists who are looking at purely private ordering, if they were to look at, you know, try to look at who these actors, if they do empirical work on who the actors are, clearly private professionals are central to all of that. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
I am very interested in this interaction of legal orders.
Yeah.
From the point of view of maybe public international law, and I somewhat do some research in environmental law and interaction with, let's say, WTO.
Yes.
And there was certain dynamics in the beginning, and then it reached a certain stage of stagnation. The certain institutions of environmental law were not really acknowledging WTO, like precautionary principle, very vaguely. So I wonder if it can be that both that certain orders really never develop. They have some interaction, but they reach the stage of stagnation and they stop at the stage of stagnation, and they really interact. They are like acknowledge each other, but they never reach certain movement or certain point of development.
Yeah.
Can I, with an eye on the time, maybe I can take Manuel on your question and then finish off with those two.
Yeah.
Just two brief comments. To some extent, your explanation about framing and the impact that has on the outcome, as a private international lawyer, broadly the topic of characterization or classification of disputes, to what extent sometimes when you characterize an issue of contract or issue of tort, that triggers a certain choice of law rule and that affects directly the outcome of the case. So to some extent, that's a further analysis.
Yeah.
But going to the main comment, I wonder whether this theory of transnational legal orders is simply a manifestation of the evolution of allocation of power in society, to the extent that it is true that maybe states have lost the capacity to govern, or the capacity diminished, and that might have taken us, like, taken them as by surprise. But the state as such is a human response in order to manage society. So maybe we could see these transnational legal orders as an evolution of the state having been outgrown by its own citizens. Citizens now being organized as companies, as opposed to human beings. And maybe in the arbitration theory, the legitimacy of arbitration as a private government mechanism is boiled down to the inherent normative capacity of human beings. So it's not the state as such. The state has certainly provided New York Convention and Arbitration Act, but it's simply the manifestation of the capacity of human beings to regulate their own business.
Yeah.
Now that happens cross borders, and in that sense, companies might have become a Frankenstein of the state, and the state not being able to control that animal any longer. And in that sense, maybe what I'm just coming to the conclusion is that transnational legal orders is simply the state having been left behind, because the structure of power went from citizens, estates, and citizens again, but in the form of companies.
Great. So that's a great question for me to conclude. So real quickly on trade and environment. I think that even to complicate trade and environment, right, is how do we frame what does trade and environment mean? And in developing countries have a very different framing for trade and environment than the United States and Europe. So U.S., and you see this within the interaction that took place within the WTO, and it's going to be ongoing. So much of, in the North, much of trade and environment is about preservation, right? Preservation of dolphins, right? Preservation of sea turtles, right? Whereas in many developing countries, the environment is much more concerned, is enlaced with every development in everybody's everyday lives. And so it's about the issues they prioritize, right, would be issues of indigenous knowledge or the Convention on Biodiversity and traditional knowledge and so forth. And so the framing of what's an environmental issue actually is really quite interesting. Who is successful in a particular frame versus, and who's not. And so you see, I think this is, but we could say a lot more, but that's just in terms of framing. And then I think the answer to the question on sort of citizens and sort of developments in transnational society, the three different constructs that I gave, right, have three different responses in some ways, I think, right? So off the top of my head. So number one, so the first is that, yes, the state is outgrown, and so you see these developments in law in terms of private ordering. And the second is, yes, I mean, Teubner's and Cagier and others, is that, yes, you know, we no longer think of terms about people as citizens, we think about them in terms of stakeholders. Right? That's a huge shift in terms of, and the argument is that they see themselves that. And the third is I think that for many of us who come from public, we distrust much of that characterization, as people are still very much bounded up in territorial ordering and territorial conceptions of identity. And that it's not a world society, but rather, you know, very, you know, grounded societies. And once you look particularly in very different societies, if you go to, you know, clearly least developed countries and developing countries, even state legal ordering is very, very weak compared to, and identity is also not based on a citizen of the state, but a member of a particular caste or member of a particular tribal group or so forth. And so there's multiple identities which are very different for different people, which are reflected in very different forms of legal ordering. But I think especially with respect to powerful states, if you look at India, China, in terms, they have their own relations with these own local orders, but the state is far, I mean, legal ordering is far from being autonomous from the state asserting itself. Okay.
Thank you. Well, I think it's time to wrap up. Thank you, Greg.
Thank you.